Here it is. Yelich sends one to right center and deep. Get up! Get up! Get out of here and gone for Yelich. He has tied the game with a booming home run. He got it all. Tied up 4-4 on a big home run to pitch. Ryan Braun.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
Right now.
Go.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Jimmy on the board. SP futures down 39. NASDAQ futures down 397. Ouch, almost 400. Brad Kevin's leading the market down. We got stuff going down here. We'll be talking about it pretty much all morning, I suspect. And we also have a little bit of we got going here in the crypto. We've got the Bitcoin down to 62,000 as MicroStrategy had to. They did lob some Bitcoins out yesterday, a very small amount of what they own, but that's not a good sign. They own so much of this stuff, and a lot of it's on margin. that would not be good if this thing goes down much further for those guys, and what else it'll take with it, you know, who the hell knows. But we have Professor Lou.
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm just peachy.
A lot of crazy news coming around here this morning. I can't say it's all the best, but it's news. You know, a lot to talk about. That's good, I guess, huh?
Well, it seems that whenever I'm on, we have lots of craziness, and we've had lots of. It seems we've just had a lot of craziness for the last couple of years. So,
you know, it might be the day of the week. We're starting to like culminate on Thursday or something. It could be. Hopefully, it's just that, eh?
Yeah, you guys are always talking about stuff that I actually have some expertise in on other days, and then you get me in here and you want to talk about stock prices, and I just go
Well, it's all sort of tied together. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know that if the listeners think I'm just jumping all over the place, which probably sounds like I am, but all this stuff is really sort of the same. I mean, it's what's going on in these other countries. It's the gold trade, the currency trade, and it's really hard for somebody who has, I'll say, a real job to kind of get the grips of all that. I mean, it's all really tied together almost like a spider web. And, you know, right now, I think for people who have benefited by this huge run-up in some of the stocks, if you own those stocks, to not talk to somebody, I mean, I don't want to be harsh, but the old saying on the trading floor, Lou, is don't ever confuse brains with a bull market. That you all of a sudden are the genius because you figured it out. I mean, there's reasons why markets go up, and when they get too high, you know, somewhere along the line, you got to take a bit and or figure out a way, have somebody like me who knows how to deal with options and maybe get you some kind of, of a hedge or something. Because right now, I mean, you look at, I'll just go two more minutes on this because I want to talk to you about more important stuff.
Well, no, you're actually touching on something that I was going to comment on that the first time that I saw it was the first time that I was a civilian in a really explosive market, and that was the dot-com bubble.
Yep.
And your comment about people being smart, don't confuse brains with a bull market, is exactly the phenomena that I observed as I was dealing with one client after another who was seeing incredible, you know, success in the market, and watching the stock prices go up, watching their equity positions go up in their companies, and you know, these companies doing really well, and the people that were in them, that were running them, that were part of them, just thought, well, I'm like the smartest guy in the room. because my share prices are going up, and I'm working with this company that's making money hand over fist, and we're all smart, and we all get to do pretty much what we want because we're so smart. And you know, as an attorney advising companies like that, you can have a field day, because they're not any smarter than anybody else, and they make the same mistakes. And because they're in a very rich environment where there's lots of money and lots of availability for opportunities to make money, they're the target. They suddenly become the target for every plaintiff's lawyer in town. But they're making the same mistakes. So what you just described is really very insightful and something I observed directly. So that's a comment I wanted to make.
Well, you know, and you read and hear stuff like that is not. I mean, I've noticed. I've talked about not so much with you, because we usually love talking about different stuff with you. But we talk about narrowness in markets and stocks running up, and then you have Hal who doesn't really. I mean, he never really talks about the market, but he's a serious observer of what the Fed is doing in monetary stuff. And then he's the first guy that I really love the fact that he did to tie together how the Fed is putting money into the system. Or let's put it this way, Louis, they don't have to put money in the system, because our system, in some ways, you and I can create money, which nobody knows. I mean, if you think about it, everybody knows, but if you don't, If you walk into a bank and borrow some money and put it in a checking account at the bank, you just made money. You created M2. So if I have $100,000 in the bank, okay, I'm going back to when you actually had reserve requirements, which of course we don't anymore, which is idiotic. But that was a Greenspan thing. I think it was a Greenspan thing. It was 2008. Might not have been Greenspan, whoever the hell it was. But so say there's a 20% reserve requirement. The bank now gets to loan you $80,000. And so if you put the 80 back in the bank, how much money's in the bank? Well, there's my 100 and you're 80, right? So now they can lend 64 on the 80 to, say, Jimmy. Jimmy puts his money in a checking account in the bank. Now how much is in the bank? 100 plus 80 plus 64. So the money in the pool increases in our system. It's not like it's all tied to gold or anything like in the old days. In our system, people create money and people can get rid of money. If Jimmy decides he doesn't like his project anymore and he pays the loan off, guess what? Now the money supply drops. So what the Fed needs to do to maintain a money supply growth where they want it, sometimes they have to add money to the pool, and sometimes they have to pull it out. So you ask yourself, how the hell in the last month or two could the money supply be growing as fast as it is? Because in the Fed actually dropping the balance sheet, you sit there and scratch your head and go, wait a minute, it looks like they're going the other way, but they're not. Because with the way the market has run up, the amount of available credit for people, let's just look at Micron. Micron went, I'll be round numbers, it went from 300 to 1,000, which is really unbelievable, but they did. And I don't know if they struck gold somewhere or whatever. I'm not telling anybody to sell Micron. I'm just saying it's an unusual run-up, let's put it that way. Well, if everybody had all their Micron stock in PTI, which obviously they don't, but they're in brokerage firms someplace. I mean, somebody might still have a paper certificate, but I don't know who the hell that guy is. It's in a brokerage firm someplace. Well, that now gives those people with 1,000,000,001 shares outstanding times $700, for God's sake, Lou, it's almost $800 billion in available. This is equity. Not to mention the fact you can borrow another 50% on the $800 billion. And what Hal has dug up, for lack of a better term, is that not only is the Fed or the government, the monetary policy of whoever. And I don't know if it's Trump, if it's Biden, if it's Obama, whoever the hell it is. Somebody is behind the system here. And I guarantee you, Trump is not going against it, because it benefits people who own assets, people who own real estate, and people who own stocks. If the more you push that up, but the ease, if say for instance you had Micron here and all of a sudden your stock's up 100 grand, now you got 100 grand more equity in your account, you can call me or my brother and say, we don't really have anybody like this, you can say, buy me 200,000 of Starbucks, 100,000 of your equity, another 100,000, we will get you that loan, Lou, in 30 seconds. If you and I decided we want to go remodel a house, what do we got to do to get a $100,000 loan? You got to sign
rob
over
a bank.
You got to sign over your wife. You got to sign over your house. So what Al is trying to tie together, not only the availability of credit for somebody, to which who gets it, and how the banking laws, the Dodd-Frank stuff, means that regular people don't get it, or if they do, they got to give their arm for it. It's totally different. That's why when you see the market explode and you see the amount of wealth pop with it, the amount of credit with it, that's why the Fed, even if they wanted to, was having trouble keeping a lid on this M2. But to tie all this together, and then you can be a relative dopo and say, well, wait a minute, the value of the dollar is steady versus the pound or the yen. Yeah, they're all doing the same thing. But the hard part, Lou, and you're not as much of a mid-America stuck in Chicago guy as I was, and are. Most people look at the dollar in their pocket and they say, man, the price of gas just went up. Well, gas is a little different because of the Strait of Hormuz thing. Man, the price of baseball cards just went up. Man, oh man. No, they didn't. The value of the dollar in your pocket just went down. If you look at it from the other side, it's the dollar that's down. It's not the baseball card that's up. But it's very difficult for Americans to think that way. The only time
why do you say that? Do we have more trouble thinking that way than other cultures?
Yes, without a doubt.
Why is that?
Because we don't live in Germany, and every time you cross the border to Austria, you've got to change currency, or go back to France, you've got to change currency.
Well, they don't have to do
that. I know,
that
but I'm saying in those days, I got stuck in a international economics course at University of Chicago, and I'm a pretty bright guy, not the smartest bulb, but Lou, I was friggin' lost. And we had five or six foreign students in there. They knew that stuff on day one. The guy talk about, okay, well, if the Credit Union, the French bank did this, what happens to the dollar? And I'm sitting there going, let me write this down and figure this out. These guys knew it off the tip of their tongue. Because if we screw up and we drop the value of the, whatever the hell, the krona in Austria, guess what? Next time I go to Germany, my krona is not worth as much. They knew right away it was their currency moving and not the other stuff. But here, because we're the world's currency, we don't think like that.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So that answered my question. We're the benchmark.
Yeah. Well, it's also the only one you ever had. Now, if you lived in Buffalo and you worked in Canada, or if you have a ball player that you're an agent for that's playing in Toronto, he gets it.
Well, yeah, and in fact, this is you remember Robert Raiola?
Yeah.
You know, Robert used to talk about this all the time. That the value of a contract, even a contract signed in American dollars in Canada, was substantially less, or even in, in California, was substantially less than a contract in Wisconsin or Florida.
Well, plus it wasn't fixed.
Right. And where I see this directly, we get out of the U.S. At least once a year. Where I see it directly is when we go to Mexico or to Europe, and you suddenly watch your spending power change, fluctuate with whatever. Mexico's really, it's really evident there, because the currency fluctuation is direct, and you suddenly realize that the dollar is no longer 21 or 22 pesos, but in fact 17 or 15, and you see that come in, and it's very apparent, and the fluctuations are almost day to day. you'll get a 3, 4, 5 peso fluctuation day to day, and that matters. The only other place I've ever seen it, and I've told you this story before, is that I was in Moscow in when it was 98 when the ruble crashed, and I've told you the story about going in and changing dollars into rubles for shopping purposes, and I was going out with some of my Russian business guys, and they said, "How much did you change?" And I said, "I was going to change 200 bucks into rubles," and it was like 1,000 to 1, 1,500 to 1 at that point. And they said, "Hold off, change 25." And I went, "Okay." So I changed 25, and as I walked down the street of the Arbat, which is one of the big shopping districts in Moscow, I could almost feel the panic that was setting in as storefronts started pulling. The first thing they did was they started changing the signs in the windows that showed how much to the dollar the ruble was worth. And so I walked out, it was 1,500 to 1. By the time we got into the Arbat and were doing shopping, it was 2,500 to 1.
That's unbelievable.
And by the time I finished at the end of the day, it was 5,000 to 1. And the people had just stopped. They had just stopped selling. They had stopped selling for rubles. I walked in. They told me, "Don't even change anymore, my friends. So don't change anymore. Just go in with dollars." And the merchants were thrilled, but they stopped selling in rubles. Imagine your national economy, your national currency, suddenly being valueless in your country. That's what happened. It was a mix of terrifying and fascinating.
Who's the winner?
Well, in this case, the winner was the guys that were holding the dollars. They were holding what the Russians called hard currency.
But the winner is also, I'm going to be snide here, but the friends of Trump's grandfather in the Weimar Republic that now took those rubles, walked down to the bank, and says, "Here's my mortgage, buddy."
Oh yeah, exactly. Well, and that's why,
or the owner of, say, the Doral. Here's my mortgage.
That's why the merchants stopped taking them. They said, "We're not. This currency's going valueless." What had happened, and I think I told you this, what had happened was there had been a huge, $300-400 billion loan into the Russian central bank.
Is this part of the long term capital thing? Is this coincidental with that?
This is World Bank.
Okay.
Yeah. They'd been like a $300-400 billion infusion of.
So, I guess what year are we talking about?
98.
That's kind of when the long-term stuff was.
Yeah, a $400 billion infusion of money from the World Bank into the Russian central bank, and it was gone. And that was the discovery. It had been completely looted, and suddenly everybody realized that there was nothing backing up the ruble.
Is that what affected the long-term guys? Must have been.
I don't know.
That was about the same time. It was my last year on the board, 98.
I was not privy to that kind of sophistication in my finances. All I knew is that, the old bit about, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I was suddenly a very desirable customer because I was paying with dollars.
Well, it gets person to person. If you just would have kicked my ass in golf the day before and I owed you 100 rubles, guess what?
Here's
100 rubles. It isn't worth squat, but here it is.
This is now one fifth or one quarter of the value of what you had. I mean, it was, as I said, it was an invaluable experience because I've never been in a economic panic environment before. But boy, that was.
But every time there's a panic, somebody's making out.
Yeah.
That's the scary part.
Yeah. We know who was making a book on that. It was suddenly Russian accounts in Cyprus and Malta and the Channel Islands and Nevis suddenly exploded with money.
If you know, and I've told this story before, but it's shuddering to me today. We had all these people. We had several people from Mexico used to come up here, and well, we never put on the seminars, but we were part of them. We had the mock trading on the floor, and you know, we were the pros from Dover that back when you had a trading floor that. We arranged a bunch of lectures from the Options Institute and those kinds of things. But so we had four or five guys who were kind of up the chain. These are older dudes up the chain at the Mexican government because they're trying to put together a futures exchange and an options exchange down there. And so they devalued their currency that week a little by like 10%. I said that one of the guys, you know, downstairs guzzling cocktails on us, of course, and the guy says, I said, you know, I feel sorry for you guys devaluing your currency. He goes, what do you mean? And I go, what do you mean? What do I mean? He said, well, if you're tied in, you move your money offshore that night, move it into dollars, and the next day when it comes back, you got 10% more money than your neighbor. I'm going, I couldn't debate him on the mechanics of it, Lou, but I'm thinking, this is horrible to say, but I've met several people from Mexico. Is stealing people from other Mexican people, is that a national sport down there or what? I mean, it sure seems like it is. Here too. I don't know, but
I have no idea. But I don't characterize Mexico as a high trust culture.
But the guy's like, yeah, if you know about it, you move it. You move your 100 pesos offshore, and you bring it back the next day, and it's worth 110 pesos. And I go, well, that's cool, you know. But I mean. The fact that this is not normal logic for normal people, it's sort of like me going through a law with you. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I guess I'm smart enough that if you really explained it to me, I'd get it. But you get tired of explaining it to me, you know, type of thing. And this is the kind of stuff that's kind of happening now with all this stuff. I mean, these kind of movements, nobody gets. It's not the 60s or the 70s where everything is kind of plotted along and. You grew by 4%, and everybody, you know, you had a little bit of inflation, but not very much. And inflation was 2%, and people's raises were 3.5%. And you know, that's the America that we kind of long for, not in terms of healthcare or anything like that, but in terms of everybody can kind of move up together. And now it's I get this feeling that if you're not cheating, you're not trying, and only the people that are finding an angle are making out to the detriment of other people. And it's just not mentally healthy, Lou, and that's what I'm feeling. I don't know if I'm the only one, but I mean it sure seems that way to me. But hey, let's talk about
talk about submarines.
Yeah, you know, just for the listeners, I spotted this thing yesterday, and I go, I know just the guy, and I couldn't understand even the construction they were talking. We're talking about the last one of a three-class submarine group, and I forget the name of the class, was named...
The Seawolf.
The Seawolf, and it was named the Jimmy Carter, because Jimmy Carter was in submarines, in a nuclear submarine.
Yeah, he was a nuclear submarine officer, a nuclear engineering officer.
Yep. And evidently the last one, they decided they didn't need another boomer, but what did they do? They, instead of putting
well,
all
the... Well, so the Seawolf... Go ahead. The Seawolf is an attack sub. Okay, so it is not a strategic missile launch submarine like an Ohio class.
Okay, so it's not as Seawolf, big.
Yeah, the Seawolf, it's big, but it's an attack sub. So it's designed to run, you know, very quietly, very fast. It's got lots of weapons that, you know, hunt other subs, weapons that hunt surface ships. That's what it was designed for. So when they realized that the thing was so incredibly expensive that they could only build a few of them and the Cold War, you know, starts to wind down, they said, we're going to do something else with this.
How many years ago are we talking on this stuff?
Oh, I can't remember when it was commissioned, but
well, it's not like 10 years ago. It's further than that.
No. It's been around for a while. And so this, they took this thing and they put a... kind of like a hangar or an extra room on the thing.
So it's bigger.
Feet long.
It's bigger?
Pardon me?
It's longer. I couldn't figure out whether they put 100 feet extra in the middle or they expanded it.
They put it on the sail. They put it on top.
Oh, okay.
So the sub is now modified with a it's effective. It's not a container, but it's an extra area on the sub built in on top of the boat that can be used for all kinds of stuff. And I call it a hangar because one of the things they do with it is that you can flood it independently of the rest of the vessel and release smaller submarines out of it. And when I say smaller submarines, I mean things like Navy SEAL subs.
Those that don't, when you see the sub on TV, you see the Hunt for Red October, you see this big long thing, and this little tiny thing, relatively tiny thing in the middle, like four guys standing on top of it. That's the sail, right? And normally it's very small and it's very aerodynamic, water dynamic, so it makes no noise going through, and it's supposed to be very small, but this one isn't. This is bigger, is what you're saying.
Right. Now, I'm sorry. So the Jimmy Carter was commissioned in 2005. I just pulled it up. I knew it was a late submarine. But the thing is that it's designed, the new hull section, as I said, sort of sits on the top of the boat, and you can put stuff in it. You can put a mini submarine that'll hold like six or eight SEALs. Now they get launched underwater. You know, they put their scuba gear on. They strap into the submarine. My recollection, the last one of these things I saw was, you know, that they literally are exposed to the ocean. So they get in, they strap in. That sail section on the Carter floods. The submarine that these SEALs are riding in is just basically a large torpedo that they can drive, and it pops out of the back or out of the top of the submarine, and then sails off, and they go do their thing. You know, they sail off. Sometimes they'll surface, and it'll put them ashore. Sometimes it doesn't. It sails along, and they drop off and leave the mini sub somewhere on the bottom and up like a harbor. And they get out and they swim over and put mines on boats, or they tap into phone cables, or they tap into other things on the seafloor.
You need people to do that. They actually do the tapping.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things they can do. We now have robot vehicles that unmanned vehicles that can launch out of this area, and they can drive off and do things outside the submarine, tapping into cables.
Want to see the principle on what Drew's talking about? Next time you're up in the middle of the night and you see Voyage at the Bottom of the Sea, and one of the guys goes out in their skin diver outfit, they walk into this column and they flood the column, and the guy swims out the top, right? And when you come in, you go back in, and they drain the water out. So it's the same sort of principle.
Same principle, except you're doing it with an area 100 feet long that can accommodate, as I said, substantially large vessels.
What does that do to the quietness of the sub? It can't be as quiet as the other one with that big honking thing up top.
You got to be really careful when you flood the area, because that makes noise, and you have to be careful when you repressurize it. And that, by the way, is one of the reasons why the unmanned systems are pretty good, because you can flood those things a good distance away from where they're actually going to be launched, so that you don't have the noise of air escaping or water coming in. And that thing stays, and it can stay flooded for hours, which you don't want to do with if you've got people in there. So the unmanned system can be flooded, you know, a day in advance, and then you sail into your target area, and then you just open up the doors, and this thing, the robot vehicle, comes out, flies along. I'm assuming, because you don't get the same kind of radio propagation through water that you do through air, I'm assuming that the robot vehicle that gets launched is either autonomous, which means it's got its own navigation and programming, or it's wire controlled. And you know, it flies out. It's got a little wire trailing back to the submarine, like a number of our torpedoes, and it zooms out into the water, and this wire trails out behind it, and somebody in the submarine can control it that way.
Well, what are the, when I say the logistics, I mean, I screwed myself over once by reading this amazing article, and this had to be, God, it had to be 20, 25 years ago, on a guy, was a newspaper dude, and he was allowed to go, and he wasn't on the aircraft carrier the whole 6 months, but that was his job. He basically covered a deployment of a nuclear aircraft carrier. This is like 25 years ago. And at the time, the part that in there that always interests me, because I don't know as much about the flying on and off as you do, is the logistics of it. And there were 16 aircraft carriers, and we, the U.S. of A., wanted 4 of them out at all times. There was one in the Mediterranean, one in the Indian Ocean, one Pacific, and I guess one in the Atlantic. I'm not sure where the L.A. were, but there's 4 of them that we wanted out. Well, in order to do that, if you go out for 6 months, you come back in, you tear the thing apart, that crew pretty much leaves. It takes you another 6 months to put the thing back together. You shake down crews, you put the air wing back on. So basically it's 6 months on and 18 months off. But if you decide you want to drop down to 12 aircraft carriers and you want the same coverage, now you're down to 8 months out, which is a much bigger deal because those things start to, I won't say fall apart, but how many times that elevator goes up and down in 6 months, it's pretty well shot. You can't just leave it out there another 2 months and expect it to. So whenever you do anything like that, you mess with your logistics pretty dramatically. Now, my question with this thing is, you got one of them. It can't be out there all the time. And what if the thing's in the Atlantic and you want to drop some SEALs off in Philippines or someplace? I mean, how do you work it with just one? Because there has to be downtime for the thing. I mean, how does that even work?
All of that, because of the nature of this particular vessel, all of that is so highly classified that
the logistics of it. If you need it in the Pacific, you got to get it from the Atlantic.
I mean, Hal would have a better idea of how they would actually staff that thing. But so your missions would be planned out maybe, you know, years, 2 years, 3 years in advance.
Yeah, but if you get a war, all of a sudden, I mean, you're not going to put this thing through the Panama Canal or the Suez Canal to see it.
No, no, it'll sail around the South Africa or around the Cape Horn and Cape of Good Hope or Cape Horn or under the North Pole, and it, you know, it's nuclear, so it doesn't have to surface for anything.
Well, you guys got to eat though.
you can resupply. You can resupply them at sea.
Okay.
And I presume they do, because where that submarine is a very, very important piece of information. And so the only time you want to see it is when it surfaces off the coast of its home base and it sails into the harbor.
They put the pirate flag up when they come in?
I know they put pirate decals on the ship, and they may fly the pirate flag when they come home. That for the listeners, that's indicative of a successful classified mission.
If I was the head of the Navy, I'd want 2 of these things. I'd want one on each side.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're incredibly expensive, and this boat, this particular vessel, is an incredibly capable submarine. That's why it was so expensive. So you don't have a lot of them, and you haven't built a lot of them. You know, this is really one of these deals where somebody said, okay, we're going to have a fleet of these sea wolves snarking around, you know, threatening whatever, you know, deterring conflict. And all of a sudden somebody goes, no, it's too expensive. We're only going to get 3 of them. So somebody in the Navy goes, well, you know, these are some of the most capable boats we have and are going to have for some time. Let's take one of them, since we're not going to deploy them as a, you know, attack in a group as attack subs. Let's take one of them and turn it into this super boat. And that's what they've done. I suspect that vessel has technology on it that we haven't even heard of.
Well, when they start talking about being able to intercept fiber optic cable messages on the ocean floor, for God's sake, that's interesting.
Yeah, but that would be something you wouldn't even, the boat necessarily wouldn't have to have that capability itself. It would have to have something on it that it could launch that could do it. I'm thinking in terms of its detection capability, its sonar capability, probably its capability to communicate with satellites even while submerged.
How do you do that?
Well, that's one of the things. That's one of the things we've been working on for some time, because there are ways to communicate with submerged vessels. You use an ultra low frequency radio signal to penetrate the water. The sub has to come up to a certain depth to do this, and this is old technology.
Yeah, but how do you tell a sub it's time to come up and listen?
You have to. They have programmed listening checks,
okay,
where they'll come up to a certain depth and see if there's been anything or see if anything's being broadcast to them. It's a very slow way of transmitting data.
Well, that was the whole theme of the Gene Hackman movie, where it was a mutiny, right? Tell us the name of that movie.
With the USS Alabama,
Crimson Tide. Yeah.
Crimson Tide.
Well, that was the whole thing. He thought he had the order to launch a nuke, and the other guy says, we better check that one out, and he didn't want to go back to the depth. You needed to talk to people again a second time or something.
Right. So this, I assume this boat we've advanced since then. I assume this boat has some kind of capability where it can either get high speed data or has some other kind of instantaneous communication system. And it I assume it has other technology, like probably some fairly advanced weaponry, maybe, that again, we don't, you know, it's too expensive to put on our vessels as a routine matter.
When I say could you, you can do anything if you want to spend the money, but if you needed one or two more of these things, I'm not saying you do, could you, like, retrofit one of the old boomers or something?
Probably not for this mission.
Okay.
I mean, there's two more of these boats sitting out there. If you wanted another one, you could retrofit it. And we have, more likely what would happen is we would take one of the new class, I think they're called the Columbia class, submarines, attack subs. We would take one of them and retrofit it. The boomers are unlikely, but the ballistic missile subs are unlikely for this kind of mission because they're slow. Yeah, they're very quiet, but they're slow. You want something that's quiet and fast.
Right. So, hey, just in terms of logistics, and without going crazy on the politics, what does it do? I mean, obviously, we've got this thing going in Iran. Now, the logistics of it is it's halfway around the world. Now, we've got bases, we've got stuff. I don't know what the military people were directed to do, but, all right, we're pushing 3 months. I don't think it was supposed to be that long. I mean, I don't know what they were told or what we were told or, you know, the difference between the X tweets and what actually was going on. So I don't really want to get in. I mean, I can't say. But Lou, what if it's... Hope to God it's not. What if it's 6 months, 9 months, 12 months? What does that do to the logistics 12,000 miles away? I mean, they couldn't possibly have planned for that. I mean, they probably didn't think it was going to be over in 2 weeks like we were told. I mean, what does it do if all of a sudden, I don't even want to say, what if it's 2 years from now and we're still screwing around over there?
It puts a huge strain on our forces. It puts a huge strain on our logistics. You had the George Washington, the aircraft carrier, that just returned to Norfolk, and it had been out. It was supposed to be out 6 months. They ended up extending it. They ended up extending it over and over and over, and you know, you can resupply the boat, and they did, but it puts a tremendous strain on the crews. It puts a tremendous strain on your operation. And they had, you know, they when they came home, they were not in great shape. But if that's what your combat operations require, that's what you do. And you tell, I mean, the weapon systems are designed for an extended kinds of operations. The biggest issue, from my perspective, with the Air Force in particular, is that most of the airplanes that we're flying are 15 to 20 years old, at least. And some of them are older than that. And so old systems that are stressed like this, things happen. And you know, pieces break, maintenance costs get higher, you start having a combat effective rate that drops because your planes are broken. And this puts a big strain on it. And I mean, we've sort of practiced for this with the global war on terror. And I mean, it's one of the things that I'm sure China looks at and kind of marvels at, that we can engage with a significant amount of force 12,000 miles away from our home base. But this is frankly exactly what the Pacific War is going to look like, except a much higher intensity and a lot of casualties. Well, we're going to be fighting. We're going to be fighting with what we've got at extended ranges over extended times.
But our guys are, again, I go back to that article I read, and I had no idea actually until I read it, that the when an aircraft carrier, even if it's one of the new ones, if you bring it back after 6 months, he goes, and you look at it 2 months later in Norfolk, it looks like you're making a new one. He goes, the catapults after how many thousand planes go off it in 6 months, they're shot. The elevators are shot. I mean, it's not like, because you can extend it a little while because guys know how to keep it going out on the water. He said, but you can't do it for 2 years. They're just shot. I mean, the stuff, now you're talking about, I didn't even think about the planes, but just the ship itself, there's only so many times you can open and close that door before the door needs a new door.
I mean, this is all, you know, military professionals say that you know, wars are won with logistics. You know, how much can you keep in the field for how long, and you know, we have an idea that conflict should be relatively quick, and you know, strike hard, strike fast, and you know, causes maximum damage to your opponent, and then everybody goes home. It may not be that way.
Well, just the simple stuff on a daily basis.
We may not have that option.
There's 10,000 people on the thing. They're serving four meals a day. Gee, the stoves are wearing out.
And I think it was the Ford, right, that had the bathroom problem.
No, they had the fire in the laundry.
Well, there was a fire in the laundry. That was one problem, and that creates all kinds of issues. But I think it was the Ford
that had the bathroom
problems.
That was their latrines.
Yeah, their latrines weren't working perfectly. And you want to shut down an operation and affect morale. Make it so people can't go to the bathroom, or there's the smell of, you know, stuff throughout the ship because your toilet systems can't get rid of it effectively.
Well, Hal was saying that evidently the fire in the laundry room, you know, who knows, but was allegedly blamed on like lint or something. And Hal,
cleaning lint filters is a big deal.
Yeah, and Hal was saying that he talks about his tour on the thing. He had to be the oldest. I think they retired it the minute he got back. He was on some kind of a nuclear cruiser, but not a big one, a smaller, just a little bit bigger than a destroyer kind of thing. And he goes, the thing was, you know, basically falling apart. And he goes, and when you're on there, everybody has you got you're on for like 8 hours, but then you had like 4 or 5 hours of maintenance stuff.
Yeah.
Before he says, you're constantly doing something. He says, but as the longer you're out there, this little maintenance thing will slip, then the next one will slip, because you just don't have the time or the parts to do it. And he goes, just like that, if that lint thing is supposed to be cleaned every 6 months and you're not back in the dock in 6 months, if you don't figure out you better do it at sea somehow, you're going to cause a fire. But he goes, that's the kind of stuff that can easily slip if you're out longer than you're supposed to be, you know, type of thing. And, you know, can cause damage. I mean, nothing. There's no small problem on a ship, is there?
No, and you know, when the Navy reported that fire on the Ford as a laundry fire, uh, that that really, Minnesota, you sort of think, okay, a washing machine caught on fire. No, it was apparently a very significant conflagration that was hot enough. And this, if this is the case, then you've got real issues. That was hot enough to actually temper the metal in the walls of the vessel. So now you have to literally somebody will have to go through and check the whether that metal that was in the area where the fire was made brittle or changed, or the engineering specs on it changed as a result of being exposed to, you know, 1,000-1,500 degree heat. And that's a huge, you know, that's a structural issue.
Well, what do you do with that and something that big?
Well, that's what I mean. So this laundry fire was not some minor issue.
Well, they were in a port for how long?
Yeah, it was a big fire. They had to tear out a bunch of stuff. They had to test a bunch of other stuff. So you know, as much as we rely on you know, our magic weapons and technology, there are some basic things that happen on a ship that if they go wrong, you can lose the vessel. We lost an attack ship, a surface attack ship called the Bonhomme Richard.
I remember that.
Named after, yeah, John Hall, John Paul Jones. It burned to the point where it was no longer salvageable. It burned in dock in San Diego.
I remember that.
My understanding is they thought the fire was set, but it burned for, you know, days, and we couldn't put the fire out. And the ship's a loss. They had to write the thing off. You know, a multi $100 billion vessel that is just gone because we couldn't figure out how to put a fire out. And so fire on a ship is a huge deal. And that's why they practice damage control. That, interestingly enough, was one of the big differences between the Soviet Navy and, I presume, the Russian Navy and the U.S. Navy, is that the Russians, our assessment was that the Soviets and the Russians were terrible at damage control. And if you want proof of that, you can look at what happened to the Moskva, the cruiser that was the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet, that got hit by a couple of cruise missiles at the start of the war, and sank. You know, they couldn't save the ship. Something that I know our crews practice for every day, how to deal with something like that.
We also, I mean, you look at the World War II stuff, and I read some summary on this where they talk about our admirals all were kind of like engineer kind of guys that were very concerned with watertight doors, with, you know, hoses that drain so you wouldn't have gasoline in the hose, that kind of thing. And other people just didn't think of that.
Well, if you again, we have this kind of mindset traditionally in our armed forces. So when World War II rolls out, our aircraft had something called self-sealing gas tanks. If you hit the fuel tank on one of our aircraft that was coming out after about 1941, the gas tank would seal, had a self-sealing capability.
It had like a rubber bladder in it, didn't it?
Yeah, that would stop the fuel flow out so that you wouldn't have gasoline streaming out all over the aircraft to catch on fire. Well, the Japanese didn't have that. And so if you could get your guns on a zero early in the war and throughout the war and tear into its fuel system, you were almost guaranteed to start a fire. And that was the end of the airplane. We've traditionally, and I think this is our focus on the well-being of our people, which has always been a major factor for us. We worry about that. It's one of the, again, you might not believe that if you read the accounts of what happened with the Sherman, you know, Sherman tanks early on, but
look at Pickett's charge at Gettysburg.
or look at the Italian campaign in the Second World War or Korea, but our weapons designs are not they are very careful to factor in, and this is true generally of a number of Western countries, very careful to factor in crew survivability. The Russians, I mean, one of the reasons you see the Ukrainians is blowing these tanks up right and left to the loss of everybody inside, is that the Russians put their ammunition in the turret. So when one of your armor penetrating rounds from a javelin or another tank hits the turret, it ignites the ammunition almost immediately and kills everybody, and the tank's a total loss. Our ammunition is stored in a separate compartment that has what's called a blowout door on it, so that if somehow a round or a spark hits that ammunition and it explodes, the force of the explosion goes up and away from the tank, and it actually spares the crew. The Russian tanks don't do that. And so, again, that's just a design preference. It's something that from the very beginning was designed into the way our weapons were made.
Well, you know,
we think our weapons people think about that all the time.
There was a Quora thing that somehow I got involved in the military stuff, Lou, so I read like two or three of these a day, mainly because I could prepare to talk to you. But one guy said, when did the Japanese Air Force start to lose the war? And the guy said, that's easy, at Pearl Harbor. And I'm going, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
He said they never, when they were launching people from aircraft carriers, it was not part of the Bushido or their honor code or whatever. They never strung out some destroyers essentially on the way back for people who were shot up and had a ditch and pull the pilots out of the water. If you couldn't get your plane back and you died, well, that was part of the warrior code. So even in battles they won, they lost pilots because they didn't give a rat's ass about rescuing them. So even the days they won, they'd lose 200 pilots and they should have lost 50.
Yeah, and so that was one of the big keys to Midway, is when they sank those four carriers, they not only took those carriers out of the fight, the Japanese could build more of them, but they took, you know, 1,000 skilled aviators.
Yeah.
off the board.
They had no rescue ships around to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
They just didn't plan for it. If you lost your plane, you were out. You were a bad guy.
That's a factor. And think about the effort that we took to get those two guys that were shot down in Iran.
Yeah.
You know, the incredible resources that we devoted to pulling those guys out of...
Is it possible to get a read? Now we've done the stuff with Ukraine. What condition? I mean, nobody's gonna. You probably have some inkling, but what condition are we in supply wise compared to like 3 years ago? Are we drained a little bit, a lot? I mean, are we kicking up production? Can we pick up? I mean, where are we in this? Does anybody even know?
Well,
or is it?
We're okay. So we're kicking up production, but this is not like we're making Q-tips or something like that. This takes the lead time for kicking up this production is measured in years. So we have drawn down, as I understand it, we have drawn down our stocks significantly. And I think one of the reasons you may be seeing this pause right now is that we are looking at, or somebody is looking at what's happened and said, okay, we need to maintain a certain minimum of equipment to deter China and to deal with whatever we think might happen in the Pacific. And we may, I don't know this for sure, this would obviously be highly classified information, but I suspect that part of the reason we have this ceasefire is that we are approaching a point where we don't want to reach into those China stocks for defensive weapons and things like that. And it's, as I understand it, Tom, it's defensive weapons. It's things like Patriots and surface-to-air defensive
systems. Plus, they all got to be in the Pacific. You're not going to get them over to Iran. How are you going to do that?
Well, I mean, they can move them, but I mean, my point is that we have to be able to defend our bases, and we have to be able to defend the Gulf states that are relying on our help.
Yep.
And so a lot of those stocks have been expended, and I suspect that's the... That if I had to point to a linchpin here, I would point to our defensive ordnance and stocks of defensive ordnance against ballistic missiles and high-speed drones coming in.
What do you do if you lose something that's, you know, an F-15, an F-16? What if we lost five F-18s? Is anything being built today?
The Air Force is building new F-15s. It's called the F-15EX.
Okay.
And the Navy, I think the production line for the F-18s are still open.
But how many are we talking a year? We can't go from 20, can we?
Those aircraft. F-35 is rolling off the production line at a pretty good pace, and so that's our new, that's our new universal fighter capability right there. But that's, we're not making any more bombers, although we are. We're making the B-21, but it hasn't rolled. It's not rolling out into initial operational capability yet. We're not making any more heavy, bomber aircraft coming off aircraft carriers right now. So yeah, this is an issue.
Well, if we had, say for instance, 25 B-2s or B-1s, the B-1, the big swing wing jobs, how many of them could fly tomorrow? I mean, are they pulling?
I think we purchased originally 100 of them. We've lost a couple in accidents and training. I think, and the reason we replaced it is because it was getting expensive to maintain. I think we can field, 50, 60 of them.
But if you need a part, you're going to go pull it off another one, or are they in inventory?
Good question. I know they're probably cannibalizing some of them, but 3D printing is letting you replace some of these parts just on a piecemeal basis.
Well, people can do... That's kind of what my nephew does. Well, his firm, and he's pretty good at it, where somebody, actually one of their clients, I think, is Owens Corning or somebody, that they'll have some big, huge machine, and it's been working since the 70s, and all of a sudden they go, oops, these five parts, and that's what they do. They machine those, some of them with the machines like you're talking about, or some they just put on a lathe and guys make them.
Well, I was doing in Italy, when I was working in Italy. Was working for a company that basically running a company that designed 3D printed replacement parts for expensive stuff.
How much more of an advance is the 3D versus those machines you could program and the thing does everything to the piece of metal?
The computerized machining.
Yeah.
The 3D printing gives you capabilities those machines don't have. Now, those machines are a lot cheaper in terms of the actual finished product. But you're also
starting with the piece of metal that you want too, right?
That's right. 3D printing gives you the capability to go from ground up in terms of composition as well as shape and design. So
you guys got enough water? You guys got enough water where Lake Mead's not dry or what?
No, we're getting rain here now, but it's not enough. It's going to be a bad year for Lake Mead and Lake Powell.
All right, but SP is down 31. We're actually coming back here. We're only down 384 in the NASDAQ. I don't see the stocks that are down all that much here. I mean, we've got Micron down 78. We've got Marvell down 21. AMD down 23. But some stuff is up. We've got Microsoft's up 5. And we've got Apple up 2. So we got our guys?
Good morning. What's up, checking in from Florida.
How are you? Kenny Polcari says it's hotter than hell in Florida.
You know, it has been, but I woke up this morning, walked outside, and it was like a morning in the middle of the winter.
Really?
It was cool. Yeah.
Is the alligator still in the swimming pool?
The alligators are wherever there is water.
Oh, God. I can't believe it. You moved to mosquitoes and alligators and humidity.
Yeah, but I left DC. There's different kinds of wildlife up there. So
you mean Andrew?
that would be telling.
Andrew, your name was bandied about yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to listen.
I missed it. What happened?
Russell's daughter, she's fascinating, young Maggie, who goes to George Washington University, and last year she was I think CBS, NBC, and she actually had a pass for the Capitol, and now she's working for some group that monitors mergers and acquisitions and stuff, or she's going to be doing that this summer. And she does it while she's in school. She goes to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and she works the 2 days a week. And she really wants to be like a correspondent, foreign correspondent. I mean, she absolutely loves it. And I said, well, somewhere along the line, you got to meet this guy, Andrew, because that's been his whole life. He can let you know whether you're on the right track, you're learning the right stuff or whatever. He's a good guy. So I basically was touting you as a father figure in the industry for this young lady.
Well, I actually talk to a fair amount of young people that I meet at the press club here down the street. So I'd be glad to do it. We got to keep her away from Wayne, though, because he was pressured by the Society of Professional Journalists into giving a lecture to young aspiring journalists in college. And he said, do you really want me? And they said, yeah, we're having our convention. Give them some career advice. So tell them what you said, Wayne.
Well, I told him, well, look, unless you got very wealthy parents, I said, you're going to have to be very frugal in how you go about this. I said, you know, you want to get a, you know, position maybe as an intern, but also to save money in D.C., you go to the morning day book and see what all the different conferences are, breakfast meetings, luncheon meetings, and then dinner time receptions for all these various groups. And you go to those things and you get free breakfast, you'll pick up a free lunch. And in the evening, you'll get some hors d'oeuvres, and if you're really lucky, you'll get some free booze. So that was my advice to him.
We talk about goofy stories. John and Jerry and Dr. J, he and I were doing the show on the Score. That's how I all got started in this mess. And his dad was the chief of surgery, University of Minnesota, and a major transplant guy. He was on the cover of Newsweek and U.S. News, because he did liver transplants on 12-year-old kids and so forth. Terrific guy. Big, huge man. He's a football player. Well, he was running this big shindig in one of the hotels here, where they, you know, all these hors d'oeuvres and everything. So we get up there, and John checks out the chow, and he goes, yeah, Dad's cutting back. Well, in a room next to us is another big thing all set up for whatever group they were. He goes, well, this food looks a lot better. I go, yeah, but John, they're not the surgeons. He goes, they don't care. So in we go. The guy comes over and says, hey, how you guys doing? I mean, it was some huge firm. Which branch are you from? John starts giving this guy some long story, but they had the best shrimp and everything else. He goes, this is way better than Dad's chow. Let's eat this stuff. God, this is what we did when we were younger. I imagine, Wayne, you'd understand this.
I understand completely.
But we did a couple of our seminars or receptions on Capitol Hill back when anybody could just walk right in. We always had it catered, and the staffers, they were spectacular. They'd come in, they'd grab a drink, grab a plate of shrimp, shake hands, look at your badge, and go, yeah, Options Exchange, I know you guys, which of course they didn't. Shook a few more hands, grabbed another couple of shrimp and another drink at the other end, and walked out. They couldn't have been in there 5 minutes. They were masters at it.
To flip the script a little bit and get back to our serious purposes here on Stocks and Jacks, I'll say that when I was in a position to be hiring people, particularly young people, one of the things I really grew to like is people who had worked early in their career in the hospitality sector and liked it, and who also had really terrific grades. Because here's why. If they are in the hospitality sector and like it, they have an attitude of service. And if you combine it with, you know, really good grades, they're able to take jobs to a new level. And I'll illustrate that with a quick story. I was in charge of a trade group putting on a convention at the top hotel in Silicon Valley, the Fairmont in San Jose. And partly to add a little pizzazz to our program, we brought in a radio host who would interview our speakers. And at the beginning of the conference day, he said to a gal who was probably just 22 or something like that, just out of Georgetown, can you bring me a big pot of coffee? And even though she had a very busy day helping organize the program, she said, no, here's my cell phone. Whenever you want a cup of coffee, I'll go to Starbucks and get it. And the radio host couldn't understand why she wouldn't just order a pot of coffee for him. So while he's doing his show, he'd just have it. And the reason is she knew that that pot of coffee cost our organization about $120.
Oh, God, yeah. One of those places? Yeah.
And that at the expense of extra effort by her and without telling the guy, you know, we're watching money, she just wanted, I'll get you a cup of coffee anytime you want. And that's, you know, it's a small thing, but it's something that you can. I certainly could visualize when I heard the story, and I thought, boy, this is the type of employee you want, that you want to keep, and but also, ultimately, she went to Oxford University in England to get a PhD.
Good for her.
And but during that 2 years she worked for me, I just thought, boy, this is the type of person you want. And for those who are either hiring or applying, I thought I'd interject that little tale.
And were you guys able to listen to the earlier part when we were talking about, before we get into the Jimmy Carter submarine? I always think that listeners like a little break from all the other stuff with Lou and learn something that just fascinating that you'll never forget. Anyway, but talking about what's going on with you know, with the markets and the dollar and the last week, and this is just a fact. It's not a trading thing or anything. That we had on last Friday, we had S&P 500 make record highs. Only 20 stocks in the S&P 500 made record highs on that day, which is very rare when the index, the last time it happened was March of 2000, and we all know what happened. And now there's all kinds of other stuff what the Fed was doing then versus now and everything. So you can't, but it's kind of just a little something in your mind at how narrow this is becoming. We have amazing amount of I'll use the term money or whatever credit in the market because of its run up. You've got stuff in Washington seemingly coming a tad unglued to me. I mean, it didn't even, but say that it is. I mean, I've listened to a couple of the Trump cabinet members the last few days, and a few other people. They have to go so far off the reservation now to even make excuses for what's happening. That God, I hope they all have a wife that when they get home says, "God, you sounded like an idiot." I mean, at some point they're really stretching, but by the same token, if the administration, I'll use the term, somewhat falls apart, I don't know what comes next. It could be worse. I mean, I don't see four or five Democrats saying, "Oh, we're not going to go back to what we were doing either. This is the new way, and there's going to be some common sense, moderate middle ground here." I don't know if. I mean, if Trump crashes and burns, I don't want that. I mean, because I'm not so sure what happens then. I mean, I'm at a loss for all this stuff. Is it just me?
What amazed me, I saw Bessent and a couple other administration people testifying, and
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, Bessent and a few others, Bessent in particular, he. These guys, what they do is they attack the members of Congress And they, instead of answering questions, I don't know if you heard, Ron Wyden from Oregon was asking him, Bessent, a question, and Bessent said, well, your son was involved with some guy that was associated with Epstein. This seems to be the game they play, whether it's him or this Mark Wayne Mullen, he launches into attacks on members. I've never seen anything like that. Usually when somebody's called to testify, they're rather deferential. I appeared in testimony in before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and the guy that was the chairman was what I considered a scurrilous far-right guy, anti-immigrant guy from Colorado, but I had to be deferential. You know, I didn't say, hey, by the way, you know, you hang out with KKK guys, I hear.
Yeah. it reaches the point where even, I mean, I was listening to Bessent yesterday getting lambasted by Elizabeth Warren, which, I'm not a massive fan of her style, but matter of fact, I'm probably not a fan of her style, but you listen to his testimony, and I'm sitting there going, I don't care if he was my favorite politician, he sounded like an idiot. I mean, just to kind of summarize, I mean, she had some kind of a testimony he did a few years ago regarding members of Congress trading stock, and she's essentially reading his testimony of how outrageous that is. You know, it should never be allowed. So she says, yeah. She fast forward to Trump's gang or his group, his advisors or whoever, had made 3,500 trades in the first 3 months of this year. She goes, that's half as many trades as the entire Congress did in like the last 4 years. I mean, she goes, what do you make of that? And all he would say, no matter how many times she asked him, all he could say was, you need to get your house in order in Congress and not worry about the president. She goes, my house is in order. I don't trade stocks. What are you accusing me for? No, you need to get Congress's house in order before you go attacking the president. And I'm like, what is he? I don't care if you're a MAGA guy. That sounded ignorant to me. Is it just me or maybe my prejudice is out there, but did you listen to Johnson the other day, the House Speaker?
Unbelievable!
They asked him about the. He said, "All you did was rant and rave about the corruption in the Biden family, and now you see corruption, way ahead, way more than that." And he said, "We have executive ethics officers that deal with that. That's not my job. My job is Congress." and the guy says, "Wait a minute! All you did was criticize Biden." And he instead of just stopping at that ridiculous utterance, he goes, "And oh, by the way, when Biden did this stuff, it was in secret. Trump's doing it right in front of us." How is that? So if you shoot somebody in broad daylight, it's okay. I don't care if you're. I'm not a fan of the current Democratic group at all, and I can see why people don't like that. But how, if that's your guy, how do you sit there and go, "This is my guy"? Can he do something better than that?
Yeah, and the corruption is so bad with like Kushner and Ivanka buying this island in a wilderness area in Albania. The population of Albania is now basically ready to overthrow the government over making that deal with Kushner and Ivanka. So,
Wayne, how do they even think of stuff like that? How would anybody even know? I mean, let's say you and Andrew know a lot of stuff, and if you guys decided to turn, the dark side of the force, like in the movie, how would you even know about some island in Albania?
Well, it's an incredible arrogance and greed. I heard her talking at some extended riff, and I now realize it was to make this all seem wonderful and glamorous, but she was talking about this island and resort, a lifelong dream to make to build a paradise for...
Jeff Epstein already had that dream, and he had his island, right?
And I'm thinking, is there not a pool someplace with a nice view that you can find? I mean, why do you need to do this except with a concept of historic levels of greed and ambition? I mean, it's not that hard to find water and a view if you're rich.
I would think not. You could do it on Long Island, for God's sake. Well, what, yeah, I mean,
and
what
why is it almost every James Bond villain lived on some island somewhere? You know,
Doctor No. And plus, he had people he had Ursula Andress coming to his island to pick up shells. That wasn't such a bad deal.
By the way, I came across a story that I'm gonna share with you guys, since you inadvertently mentioned it. But late in life, Sean Connery was being interviewed, and I saw the interview recently, and they said, "Well, you know, when you're in your James Bond series, there were just colossal villains, Dr. No, Ernst Stavro, Blofeld, Mr. Big, all these people. Who was the worst villain that you encountered in the James Bond series?" And Connery says, "Well, that's easy." And the interviewer said, "So who?" And he says, "The co-producer, Cubby Broccoli." And the underlying theme is, even in big successful movies, I've learned, there's a tension of trying to get the financing, get the stars, get the creativeness, and it can be very tense even on things that are successful.
Well, didn't Ian Fleming actually work for British Secret Service, right?
Oh, that's very right. High up, very high up.
Very, very high up. And I remember he was mentioned in The Man Called Intrepid. They said he had a wild imagination even then.
Well, I think he was one of the top staffers for the head of the Navy in World War II, which is, Wayne can correct me on that.
Yeah, and he also served in World War I.
Really?
Yeah. And well, had a very storied career.
Well, M.M. was essentially Bill Stevenson, right? The head of British Secret Service.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And by the way, just go back to Sean Connery. Let me also share that Fleming originally didn't like Connery because he imagined the person being much more kind of cultured. Connery came from a quite poor working class Scottish family, not really educated. He actually delivered milk and then made himself into a bodybuilder. And they had, during casting, they were trying to get somebody like David Niven, kind of elegant types. And what happened, though, with hundreds of auditions, Connery came in, you know, kind of a strongly built, rough-hewn guy, and Fleming really didn't want him, but they said, "This guy's got it. He's got charisma." So they, the director took him to London clubs for a couple months before they started the movies to kind of get him the rough edges off.
We would have to do that with Wayne. We would have to do that with Wayne, don't you think?
What's that?
We'd have to do that with Wayne if we ever wanted to push.
I think it'd be a multi-year project. But
I've been known to infiltrate cultured places, and I'm soon thrown out.
Infiltrate is the right word. go on, Andrew. Sorry.
No, that's it.
I mean. But what
you,
I mean,
you can't. Charisma comes from some inner spot that you know. You can add the charm later.
I have a funny story about when they were searching for somebody to replace Sean Connery as Bond, and you know, they were looking at several other people, including, you know, guys like Roger Moore, who eventually was chosen. There was this guy, George Lazenby, who was only in one Bond movie, but that was back in the late 60s, early 70s, and somebody in London said, you know, there's a Canadian a guy here who's a journalist on television who works out of London, the guy said, I think he could really play Bond, but he's not an actor. And they actually approached Peter Jennings.
Really? Wow.
Yes. He said he was quite flattered, but he was a journalist, not an actor. But it was something that was thought about anyway.
Well,
he thought it was a great story.
All right, guys, back to what we were kind of talking about earlier, and then we'll set this all up, and we'll go to break, and then come back, and you guys will have all the answers. But the thing I mentioned about the market, you know, I'm not looking for some kind of crash. I hope not. But then I also see, you know, the Micron up $700, and they're now 21 times revenue, which is twice my danger zone. Once a big company gets to 11 or 12, I'm talking about earnings. I'm talking revenue, because, you know, the earnings, you can cost cut and whatever and maybe make some more, but it's pretty hard to double the size of your place, you know, especially if you're a big place. I mean, if it's our hot dog stand, we could, I suppose, but it's pretty hard for Micron to double. And if they do, a lot of other places, they're not going to be able to, because they can't all double, right? Or, I mean, you wouldn't think. So we've got sort of a market at kind of a high. It's sort of, not just sort of, it's becoming, if you look at the wealth in the country, the wealth is in assets now. It's not in, you know, I know where Andrew was born. It's not like your dad or my stepfather making $100 a week and putting 20 in the bank. That's not how wealth is being built these days. Maybe for some people it is, but not for most. It's in asset appreciation, which can be fleeting. I'm not saying, you know, and a lot of people think it's gone like this for a long time. They don't even worry about it. And if you tie things together, not just on the show, but in the world, and you talk to Nancy, and Nancy will say, okay, but there's people have a big IRA, and they may have, you know, $1 million in it. Well, they don't hesitate to borrow $100,000 for an addition on the house, or run their credit cards up, because they know they've got this IRA basically in their back pocket at this massive number. And not saying it's, you know, but all of this is seemingly built on some kind of credit, some kind of appreciation of housing, appreciation of country clubs, appreciation of stock. And I don't think, I'm not predicting anything bad happening necessarily, but it seems like just the idea that it even can be happening is out of sight, out of mind. I mean, the listeners on the show, and I very seldom bring up my own business on the show, really, but I should be getting two calls a week from somebody saying, man, you know, I'm just the guy you're talking about. I got all this stock, but now I'm a lot older, and boy, if it goes down, I'm in trouble. I need somebody to help me. But I don't. Nobody seems to have any idea of the fear of any of this. And then when you go by and you criticize Trump, which we do, we also don't know that if he crashes and burns, what does that do to the country? What does that do? What kind of fight would there be afterward? I think the risks are a lot higher than people are just sort of. And if you add that to the part that the margin loans on stocks, you add that to the Bitcoin slipping down on this MicroStrategy, had to sell Bitcoin yesterday to pay a preferred stock dividend. It seems like there's this risk all over it, and nobody is even really looking at it. And, you know, which isn't to say that there's going to be a crash or anything, but why don't you take what I'm just saying and come back and solve this all for me, because I don't get the all kinds of different places there seem to be risk here, Not to mention a war that's supposed to be over 2 months ago, and it looks to me like it's going for a while. And, you know, what's that doing to countries around the world that, by the way, we hope are going to show up and buy our bonds, which that's yet another problem. I mean, I could just keep going here on the problems, but, I mean, as much as I think the three of us don't like the man in the White House, I don't want something horrible to happen to him either, and all this, it could get a lot worse. I mean, I don't even know where I'm going with this. That's why I've got you guys. So why don't we go to break, and you guys, you got 2 minutes to come up with an answer. S&P Futures down 31, NASDAQ Futures down 396. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Do you own an annuity, either fixed rate, indexed, or variable? Are you paying high fees and getting low returns? If so, Annuity General would like you to have this free book to learn the pitfalls and mistakes of buying an annuity. The Annuity Do's and Don'ts for Baby Boomers contains the little-known truths about annuities, like how to help reduce your fees and increase retirement income. And it's free. That's right, free. As a bonus, we'll also throw in a free annuity rate report just for calling. We researched over 1,000 annuities and summarized rates and benefits from financially strong insurers. You get Annuity Do's and Don'ts for Baby Boomers and the Annuity Rate Report, both absolutely free for calling Annuity General today. Hurry, supplies are limited. Call now.
800-731-1467. 800-731-1467. 800-731-1467. That's 800-731-1467.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control. Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
We're back.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Jimmy on the board. S&P Futures down 26. And if you're down 367, it's been as low as down 405. There's a few stocks that are down here, but it's not all that obvious. Some are up. Microsoft up 6. Apple's up 2.5. Meta's down 480. We got NVIDIA down 257. Micron's down 70 bucks. That's part of it. AMD's down 22. Well, some are down, but it doesn't seem as odd as you would sort of see here. But I think the futures... yesterday, the cash was down a lot more than the futures, so I think the futures are making up for that a little bit here. Over in Europe, we got the DAX actually up 141. Universal Music slumps 7% as Bill Ackman's Pershing Square offloads stake after failed takeover center. That must be some sort of a European thing. I don't know who that is, Pershing Square. FTSE down 35.3%. CAC around up 80. That's a full 1%. So sell-off here is not being reflected over in Europe. That might be somewhat of a timing thing or not. Nikkei down 931, 1.4%. Hang Seng down 379, 1.5%. Shanghai down 26.6. Asian markets fall and renewed Middle East tensions. There you go. Bonds down 4 basis points. So the 10-year is ducked under 4.5 again at 4.45. The Bund down 2 basis points, 301. And we've got the oil is down 311, down to 92.91. So that's not pressure today either. Brent down 292. RBOB down 8 cents, 305. Gold is up 57 bucks, 45.24. Silver's up 83 cents. Foreign exchange, dollar at 2 month high. Euro's down to 116.4. The British pound 134.5. And the Japan is right at their Mendoza line here at 159.8. When they get crazy when it gets to 160, and it's almost there. This is the one you got to watch. Bitcoin, 63,411, down 2,100 bucks. And I'll talk to you guys in a bit about, there was like $3 trillion or something in the Bitcoin market, and it's down to about half of that. MicroStrategy, supposedly, they're the biggest holder, I think, and their average price is 75. So I don't know what the world looks like if Bitcoin goes down to like 50, but it won't be looking all that great. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Okay, and traffic, the inbound. High of 109.
Cubs lose, Sox win, and the Knicks won. Interesting fact, you didn't know about this Cauchy bet, Chief. A bar owner called a bar in Manhattan called Jeffries said he'll take $100, a dollar off every point the Knicks score if the Knicks win. Off your tab. With taxes and gratuity not included. He also, because he bet, placed a Cauchy bet that the Knicks would win. He did take $100 off the tabs last night and still made $13,000 on his bet. Back to you.
All right, guys, you've had 2 minutes to think about all the problems of the world they threw at you. What's the solution?
I'll just say quickly that after Trump has this ridiculous UFC cage match on the White House South Lawn.
I thought they all canceled.
What's that?
I thought they canceled, or was that the other thing?
No, that was the Freedom 250. It was a concert, and the only person left standing was Vanilla Ice. I thought it was interesting that Jimmy Kimmel said that many of these acts that eventually canceled, like the Milli Vanilli and the Commodores and others, he said their agent and their promoter was a guy named Jeff Epstein. Not that Jeff Epstein, but another Jeff Epstein.
God.
Yeah. But right after that ridiculous cage match, he's flying off to the G7 conference. I believe it's in Italy. Maybe France, but I think it's Italy. And I think that is probably going to be a very critical meeting where these other G7 leaders are going to just basically say, look, leave this one alone, because he's clearly not in our camp any longer. And God knows what political, military, economic, financial repercussions will come out of that meeting, especially if he engages in, name calling during, public press op, news conferences and things like that, press opportunities. So we may not have seen the worst yet, say.
Well, let me try to get a shot from another angle at your big question that you left us with. There's a commentator primarily on antitrust issues named Matt Stoller, who wrote a column Sunday night that purported to address, I think, the kind of comments that you raised a few moments ago. And I almost sent you the article when it came out, but then I thought you already probably know it. So the themes.
Please send it. Please send it.
But let me mention what it said in outline, because it gave an attempt to answer your concerns, although not necessarily with a happy ending. One of his themes was to draw a distinction between good technologies that are very valuable, very helpful breakthroughs, but also how the market prices them and how whether they're actually good for investors. And a couple of his examples are SpaceX. And he says, something like Starlink that Elon Musk developed, fabulous innovation, extremely vital to the world's communications infrastructure now. But the way it's been packaged with other Musk investments, including the larger SpaceX and other Musk vehicles, may not be a good investment for investors because their insiders control it, and ultimately there could be a huge problem despite the fact that there's underlying core
assets. You mean like he runs Tesla where he's going to make a trillion Tesla. He's going to make $1 trillion and you're not going to get a dime of a dividend? Duh.
Yeah, right. But when this is packaged together and that people are excited by the buzz, but at some point the professional money managers are going to have to say to themselves and to their clients, it's great. There's some great technology here, but if you're looking at your portfolio, it may not be a good idea. So that's one example he had. The other is more broadly on artificial intelligence. And he says, everybody is so excited. This is unbelievably great. And to go to your point about the stock market going up, and it's heavily influenced by a few companies. He says, if people are in euphoria because people are building and it's all great, but who's going to pay for this? And he makes two points, and then I'll finish up and see what you think. He says it's kind of like 150, 200 years ago, gold rush, and everybody's selling pick and shovels, and everybody's excited, and the community's booming. Everybody's going into the mines, and they're at the saloons, and the But what if there's no gold?
Yeah.
And he says, The companies have been giving away artificial intelligence services. I mean, I think on Google, we don't pay for Google, and
You can pay. Kevin's an expert. You can pay $20 or $30 a month if you want the better version where you can actually have it do stuff for you.
Well, yeah, but here's what he says: the companies are just now starting to charge for it. Real dollars, and the companies buying it are taking a look at this and panicking, and apparently there's some company, you guys probably know what it is, that just got hit with a $500 million bill for artificial intelligence, and they had to tell their employees, stop using this stuff unless you need it, because...
Well, you've been listening to Carl, who's convinced the return's never going to be what these guys are putting in there.
Well, and that's this columnist Matt Stoller's other point, is suppose in the gold mine there's not that much gold, suppose artificial intelligence, fabulous technology, but who can afford to use it to the degree to pay for what the investments are right now? Well, so that's the thought, the fear, I just thought I'd
what you just did regarding the markets. I don't know if you did it, if you know you did it or not. You probably do, because you guys are pretty bright dudes. The market is like, remember when Kirk and Spock used to play chess, and there are like four different levels of the chessboard?
Oh yeah.
Well, there's like about 100 of them in the market. And you just kind of picked on one of them, on the AI, and okay, is this stuff really going to be worth it? I mean, you can go back to the highest price that, what was the first TV station? Was it NBC? They traded higher than they did for like the next 15 years before the first show was broadcast. Railroads were the same way. I mean, the hype is always more than the reality. But the other part of it is when you're, there's another level of the chessboard when you look at investors, and these are not my clients, although there's a few sprinkled. You're buying it because it's going up. You're selling it because it's going down. I don't care what Micron does. It's going up. Somebody must know something. I just want in. So, and then you have the amount of liquidity that's in the market, the ease of buying, getting margin loans, like in a second. Hell, if you got an online broker, you don't have to talk to anybody. You just tell them you want to buy it. You got the loan. You've got that sort of thing going on with the momentum trading. So there's all kinds of levels to this, Andrew. And you could really make the case that if you go back, and you guys aren't 25 anymore, just go back the last 10 years and replay a CNBC from 4 years ago, from 8 years ago. 4 years ago, if you didn't hear the word cloud every 30 seconds. In the meantime, we had a guy, guest, Kevin, you know, he was running Better World Books, IT department at the time. He goes, I've been buying stuff from the cloud for 10 years. Now it's got a name to it. I mean, what it is buying computer capacity from somebody else to supplement yours in the days or months or weeks you need it. He goes, it's already becoming pretty competitive, and I can get it from the guy down the block who's got a server farm. So, but if you go back 4 years before that, and I think you guys would argue me on this, if you didn't hear the word China every other second,
oh yeah,
you didn't have your ear open. Oh God, these guys are in China. Well, you know, this company doesn't do any good. I mean, China. They just opened up a branch in China. I mean, there's always like, it's almost like it's up to people to make excuses for the fact that the market's going up, people are borrowing money, and it's going up even more. So that's kind of another kind of a dumb level to the chessboard. All this stuff's going on kind of at once, and that's kind of really what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, well, let me combine the title of his show into one person who I had a chance to observe up close, Bernie Ebbers of MCI WorldCom, a kind of tall, former basketball coach, high school basketball coach, who's about 6'4", and a nice beard. And
I remember the beard. He had a serious beard.
Yeah, well, not a beard, you know, just, you know, kind of a well-trimmed growth. And at one point, he had taken these small communications companies and leveraged them through mergers, bigger, better, and at the point of, at one point, MCI WorldCom was, you know, this huge force in the building out broadband. And this organization that I used to lead, the Wireless Communications Association, we wanted him as a speaker at our annual convention. And we'd arrange for the New York Times top telecom reporter to introduce him. And then suddenly, the MCI WorldCom said, well, he's not going to speak if you have a New York Times reporter introducing him. And furthermore, there can be no cameras in the room. And no reporters. And we said, yeah, but this is like the keynote speech at our convention.
That's what he's here for.
That's what he's here for. And they said, we're telling you that he will not speak unless you turn off the cameras. And we're certainly not having the New York Times person invited.
What, did he have a big pimple on his nose or what?
And what about the FBI listening devices?
Well, we're kind of getting there, but so at any rate, I had to disinvite the New York Times guy, which was pretty bad, but and we did turn off the cameras, but we got, you know, with some reporters, we snuck in there, and it was at that convention. Well, two things. One, I'm sitting next to him as he comes in, and I mentioned some of this background. He says, oh, I wouldn't mind. You know, that's just my staff. And then he goes and he calls off the Sprint MCI merger, which is, you know, huge news at the time. And then what happens is, of course, it turns out that a lot of his stuff was based on hype.
Oh, yeah.
That And so after he goes on trial, one of our board members from Bell South tells me, he says, we at Bell South were looking at this trial where his defense is that he's a high school basketball coach and he doesn't know anything about financial markets and he doesn't know anything about telecommunications. And he says, we at Bell South believed his BS and we're buying all kinds of fiber optics to keep up with MCI WorldCom's nationwide growth. And here's this high school basketball coach saying he doesn't know anything about any of it.
Well, the people, it's stunning the excuses where you can see it, some of the people talking in front of Congress. But the, when I was, little quick story, but the, I helped write a political document for Nancy Drew Sheehan, who was running for judge, she was running for treasurer. Illinois. So we wrote up a thing about what the treasurer does, and I wrote the finance piece, and it was no big deal because all you could do was buy U.S. government paper. You know, so if you and Wayne were the treasurers of Iowa and Illinois, you could have a big bet for a big, you know, huge, expensive drink, and all it meant was Andrew or Wayne was smarter than you that year, and he bought 2 years, and you bought 1 year, and he made 3.21%, and you made 3.19 or something. It was like. There was nothing really to do. Yet I'm looking at the list of everybody in the country, because I don't know, these guys got me the statistics. I see Orange County, California, and what the hell is the place? Harris County, Texas. Everybody's making 2.95, 3.01. These two guys are making like 10. And I'm going, wait a minute. How the hell? The federal government's paying 3%, roughly. How the hell are these two idiots making 10%. Well, then, of course, Merrill Lynch is doing all this stuff with the guys, and they're making 10. And the whole thing falls apart. Remember this? And who was the bozo that was the chairman or the treasurer of Orange County? And he knew nothing. The same guy, Harris County, Texas. He knew nothing. Well, you had to know you were making 3.5 times more than the other guy. What'd you think you were doing? I mean, it's scary, the excuses, isn't it? Oh, I don't know. I'm just sitting there, right? They told me this was all safe. How could it be safe if you're making 3.5 times as much as the next guy? Do we really have buffoons like that around in office?
Yes. and we've had them for quite some time.
I mean, it's scary. But just get back to what if all the stuff we're talking about, and you guys, I mean, nobody likes all pieces of any administration. But you mentioned the G7. You know, to me, the thing that popped into my mind is what if Trump pisses everybody off even more than he does, and they decide, whoever they are, you know what, we're gonna send this bozo a message. And I'm not me saying bozo, and they all of a sudden they show up light at the next auction. The thing that really I'm astounded by it is if I owed you two guys all kinds of money, I wouldn't be pissing you off. I mean, we owe Japan and UK $2 trillion.
I mean, well, they're already doing it, I think.
A little bit.
So somebody like Carney in Canada, he's already diversifying their economy. And of course, he's got this Bank of England background, but they're reaching out with China and Europe, and they're not making big headline threats, but I think they're doing what you suggested without talking about it.
Because, but UK and Japan in the last 2 years have made up for the China drawdown.
You know, the biggest fear right now is that Trump said this before publicly, is that he's going to demand that the G7 become the G8 again, and insist that Vladimir Putin be invited to the summit meeting, which I think could result in the meeting not even happening if he does that. And he has always said that he thought it was a mistake and that he wants Putin back at the G8 table.
I think that there's someday we may find out, or our grandkids, if we had any, are going to find out that there was something going on between him and Putin. But here's what.
Between him and the Soviets and then the Russians, I pinpoint it beginning in 1978 when he married a Czechoslovak intelligence asset.
That'll do it.
Ivana Zelnikova.
But Andrew,
it's already out there to some extent. There are books that have been written, and they're just not prominent on it. But I think gradually the kind of information Wayne just mentioned, and he's written extensively about it, including at book length, but there's others. And it will be seeping out more and more, I believe.
Well, just on the stuff we talked about regarding the numbers in the market today, someday we'll talk about whether somebody was an asset or whatever at length, but right now today there's two flashpoints, I think. One is this Japanese yen. It's at 159.80. Now, again, listeners, when you talk about the euro and it's 116.40, that means the dollar, it costs you $1.16 to buy a euro. Okay? So that's the one way of doing the math. The yen is the other way. It's how many yen to the dollar. So there's 159.8 yen it takes you to buy $1 right now. Okay, so when that gets to 160, which the problem is not only does Japan need to buy oil, it's inflated prices with the Strait of Hormuz mostly closed. It's a problem. Now, of course, Trump says they can buy them for us. Okay, but in order to buy oil, you got to take the yen and buy dollars, because all oil transactions are done in dollars currently.
Right.
So these guys are being stuck with basically hypos in both cheeks at this point. really. So, but now they did it a couple of weeks ago. Now, if it gets over 160, what they do is they take their dollar reserves and they buy yen in the open market to drive the price of yen essentially up a little bit to where it's under 160. Now, where do they get the dollar reserves? They sell U.S. Treasuries. And 3 or 4 weeks ago, they sold like $50 billion of U.S. Treasuries, which is a pimple on the ass of the elephant on the size of their investment here, which is like $900 billion, okay? Maybe it wasn't even 50. Maybe it was like 15 or 20. But it's a trend you don't want to see starting, because I don't see the people in this country ponying up every week another 15, 20 for these treasuries. And if they don't, you're going to see these interest rates go even higher. And if that happens, you're going to see the government having to pay more in interest and their deficit even going higher. So this is not stuff that's like not right there. The other thing is, what if Bitcoin drops another 15,000-20,000 bucks? There's a couple companies that are all involved in this. There's people, Trump's kids are involved. I don't know if I care so much about that, but I mean, there's people worldwide that their storehouse of value now is this Bitcoin. I mean, there's two flashpoints right now this morning out of like the 100 we've mentioned.
Well, here's the third one, just to stick with Japan for a moment, but it's broader than just Japan. Part of, you know, people complain about the price of oil and gas, but part of that price shock now around the world is because the countries like Japan are drawing on their strategic reserves. But those reserves are going down, and Japan, which really doesn't have domestic oil and gas, has been cross-subsidizing some of their manufacturing partners in Southeast Asia, which are even in worse shape than Japan. But at some point, Japan drawing down its strategic reserves as the war goes on, they can't do it, you know, forever. It's your safety reserve. And when that hits, the price shocks throughout the economies, plural, throughout the world, are going to be much worse. And add that to the two factors you mentioned.
Well, that's just a couple. I mean, not just the. I mean, I could lob out, you know, margin debt was up $80 billion last month. I mean, wherever you look, it looks like there's some place to be concerned. Now, but you can't run around like Chicken Little either. And the sky is not always falling, right? I mean, somehow we managed to work our way sort of through this. Speaking of strategic reserves, we're down to 365 million barrels from. What was our height? We were at 600 and something in our strategic reserves. We were up to 650 something in 2021, and now we're at 350. And, you know, and Trump, all he did was bitch at Biden for lowering it, and he's lowering it. You know, so between the last two guys, we're down from when did Biden take office? 2021.
Yeah, January 20th, 21, right?
Okay. Well, I've got December of 2020. So that would be December of 2020, right?
Yeah. Biden was faced with the pandemic, and I have to think that, you know, once it subsided, they were going to replenish the strategic reserve. But with Trump, we don't know what's happening with this oil. Like, we don't know what he's done with the Venezuelan tankers he seized.
He brought them to his buddy who bought the Citgo stuff.
Then he opened an account in Qatar, which was Trump's personal account.
Well, January 2021, 638 million. Now we're 350. So Biden dropped it, you know, he did it for cost or something. So Trump is what, January 2025? Correct?
Yeah. Right.
So he's, when he got it, it was already down to 393. So Biden dropped it a bunch, and Trump's continuing to drop it. So that they're kind of both doing that. But I mean, how much lower? But the other side of that coin is, you know, we've had guys on the show that were ranting and raving and bitching about the thing going down under Biden. And I'm like, you know, when we did that, when Bush was in office, I think it was we were only producing 4 or 5 million barrels a day. Now we're doing 21. So do we really need if you ask somebody today, how big does the thing have to be? The fact that at one point was 650, that's just a number it just happened to be. I mean, I don't know. I mean, is there any thought behind what the number is if we're actually producing 21 million a day when we used to do 5? I mean, I mean, it could be 3, it could be 6, it could be 20. What's the difference? I mean, how would anybody say this is the number? Right,
and the demand here in this country anyway is decreased because of, you know, electronic EVs and whatnot.
We're still pushing the same kind of, I mean, in terms of gasoline, certainly diesel hasn't dropped, I don't think.
No, that's why we're seeing the high prices in the grocery store, because, you know, those semis, you know, they're having to truck that stuff across the country.
You don't see people clamoring to buy the old rabbit diesel cars anymore. I mean,
no.
does anybody sell a diesel car anymore?
I don't. I haven't seen any. They used to have when you got behind one, you thought you were behind one of those old buses in New York or Philadelphia. Diesel fumes, you know.
Remember those old putt-putt Mercedes diesels? They'd be poking along and you'd see the thing coming out the back end.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Oh God. Well, guys, thanks much. I don't know if we solved any problems, but we've raised even more issues than maybe we thought we needed to, eh?
Yeah, there's more reason to have a few adult beverages now to kind of commiserate over it.
One. We'll take 30. What is that? The Republicans voting, switching aisles to vote for that, the War Resolution Act.
Yeah.
That to me is fairly significant, just in terms of the. You got a 30-second comment on that?
Well, both houses, the House and the Senate. And we now see some of these senators who were, challenged by Trump people and lost their primaries, really coming out strong against Trump. And we haven't seen it so much in the House, except for guys like Thomas Massie, maybe a couple others. But I remember back in 1974 when a lot of Republicans who supported Nixon started to change and say, no, no, he's got to go. I'm seeing some of that now. Deja vu, all over again.
The guys that he kicked out, are they in danger of losing to the Democrat? In other words, their seats.
Well, yeah. Tallarico definitely in Texas against Paxton. And, of course, Tillis's seat in North Carolina, all indications that's going to go to the former Democratic governor, Roy Cooper.
Probably not in Louisiana, but
no.
a very quick issue, and I'll try to apply it to Illinois, is with the Supreme Court, as one person said, taking off their hoods and really going after these black congressmen, the Democrats have a tough issue to decide. And let's take Chicago. Do you extend out the districts of someone like Jonathan Jackson from Chicago out to the western or suburbs to go after the, let's say, Darren Hood Republican seat and further endanger black Congress people, or do you just put race over potential gains for the Democrats? And in a New York Times article published today, they said a lot of the black leaders in Congress are saying, look, if we've got to extend out the districts, let's do it. And to take Lauren Underwood in the western suburbs of Chicago, that's a mostly white area, and black representatives, if they're popular and good, they can win like her. And so let's win the majority, not just protect.
Well, my area's like that. It really kind of sucks, I think. But at the end of the day, just think of the amount of, my suspicion is, when all these states do this, at the end of the day, they're going to end up in aggregate right back where they started with zillions of hours and zillions of arguments that didn't need to happen.
Well, it didn't, but you can't just take the high road, and Wayne's got a great quote on that that has historic significance because it comes from Michelle Obama via Wayne Manson. Wayne?
Well, go ahead.
No, you're the man.
She said when they go low, we go high. I said, no. When they go low, we go lower.
isn't that about the truth? Well, you guys have a great weekend. Let's hope by the end of the summer we get to see each other. S&P Futures down 22, yes. NASDAQ Futures down 330. We actually come back some, like we sort of do. We'll see where this one lands today. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. That's all, folks.